Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And we're back with episode 398 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me, as always, is Aiden Morgan.
Adam?
Aiden?
You read Tolkien? You know? The Hobbit books?
Oh.
He describes things really well. Makes you want to be in there.
So good. Yeah, we are here to discuss 2005's Brick. Ryan Johnson's first film, you know, written and directed by Ryan Johnson, obviously. It'd be weird if it was his first film and he had nothing to do with it. And starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Luke Haas, Megan Good, Emily DeRaven, Norissa Hettner, Noah Fleiss, Noah Segan, Matt O'Leary. You got some Brian White in there for your
Brian trans. And Richard Roundtree.
Roundtree.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know that was Richard Roundtree. So.
Oh yeah. The one that always gets me is the Brian White thing because I just remember him so well from S.H.I.E.L.D. And every time I see it, he's just younger enough in this that I'm like, who is that? Oh right.
That's great.
So yeah, this is this movie is like 20 years old now.
Yeah. And it turns out that the whole thing is actually just, it happens in the mind of one dying character at the beginning of the movie.
Nice. Although there is a theory about part of that.
There is. Well, I know that there is the character of Matt O'Leary's character, Brain.
Yeah, the Brain, yeah.
Yeah, that the Brain only exists.
Yeah, what's really funny is it's all based on one shot at the end.
Oh, interesting.
And I mean, obviously, we're going to spoil the hell out of a 20-year-old movie, but just to deal with that first, just because we're on it. Yeah, at the very end on the field where Brain's like, you know, like, oh, fine, don't tell me. And he crosses behind Brendan, he vanishes.
Right.
And it's just because of the shot, but people took that and ran with it, that he's not really there, which meant that he was never there, which meant that he was just a hallucination.
But in it, I can see why it works because he doesn't, you never see him interacting with anyone else. But that might just be the actor's availability. You know what I mean?
I think it was just actually just, oh, and we can get into this with the film itself, but I think it was very much on purpose.
I think so too.
And what I do like though about the theory is that like Ryan Johnson said it's like his favorite theory about the film, and he refuses to ever discuss whether or not it's true. Oh, but it also just isn't. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
At least
I like that Johnson will neither confirm nor deny though.
That's what you should do for things like that, frankly.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So how did you first because this was for people who don't know, this was a very limited release when it came out.
Right. I'm pretty sure I don't actually remember the first time. Mm. I saw this movie, although I do remember having seen it, making my family and friends all watch it as well.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many of them actually liked it.
That's fair.
But they were very polite about my enthusiasm. Honestly, there's one of two possibilities.
Okay.
Either I saw it on DVD.
Yeah.
Not long after. Or I might have seen it at in second run at the local library film theater, which is probably how I saw it.
Gotcha. Because by 2005, we knew each other.
Do we?
Did we know each other? No, maybe we didn't. That was still before
2008, I think, is when we...
Yeah. I was going to say, because I was like, if it was 25, then like you probably saw because I wouldn't shut up. No, at the time I was still living in New York, and one of the, you know, had like a limited release in LA and New York, and I think somewhere else, and I don't remember where, in the States,
in Regina, Saskatchewan,
right? Yeah. I said like other countries, obviously it had its own limited release there, but in the U.S. it was LA, New York, and somewhere else, and I don't remember where.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, again, Ryan Johnson's first movie, like, there's no way I'm going to hear about this thing, but there was, weirdly enough, for whatever reason, a poster campaign in the subway. Like, because it was playing at the Angelica, so if you went around at the time and you were riding the train, if you were in a station that was kind of close to the Angelica for like a few weeks, there were just full size movie posters for Brick.
Oh.
And it was just kind of like that same background that the poster is, you know, type of thing. But it would have I don't know if I could find any of them. It would have like a character, and it'd be like the brain type of thing.
Right.
Or the pin. And it would, I think they just had outlines, like they were like ripped out. And yeah, they would have some bit of random slang from the movie. Like some bit of the movie's random, like made up slang.
Yes. The hard boiled dialogue.
Right. And like I remember, because, you know, again, a bunch of my friends are all fans of noir and all this. That we saw through these posters, we're just like, the fuck is this? And then kind of looked it up and was like, oh, it's this like neo-noir, like set in a high school. Like, this is either going to be terrible or amazing. And just decided to go see it. Like, that, it was just pure, happened to catch those posters, happened to be in the right city at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Yeah, no, yeah. Got lucky.
Yeah, I think, indeed you did.
I was going to say, the little kicker to that is I remember getting home from the movie, and like one of my friends came back to my place to hang out, and I was like, it's like, I got to look this guy up, this Ryan Johnson guy, because holy shit, what else has he done that we've never heard of? And it was like, nothing. And I was like, okay. And I found his website, and he had like a bit of like the novella version of it, because he had written it in prose.
Right.
And he had some posts about how he'd like, he tried it this way and he couldn't really sell it and he wasn't really it wasn't really good. And I read it and I was like, fuck you, that's like someone's third goddamn novel. Like, how dare you be like in your early 20s, this good a writer and just like, nah, I'll just do it as a movie and then that good at that. I'm like, just, you dick. But yeah. Yeah, no, instantly a huge, you know, like I need to see everything he does from then on. And I have.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like now that, well, we're talking, I am 99.5% sure that I saw it at the RPL Film Theater when it came through on a second run. They probably actually just project the DVD onto the screen.
Yeah, I'm sure. A lot of second run theaters do that. And hey, like Blu-ray, you're good enough to do that with in a small theater.
Yep, exactly. And it looked, and I was just, I don't know. I knew the basic idea behind it, like a neo-noir set in high school. And, you know, being a fan of, you know, Buffy and so on, I'm like, yeah, give me weird genres in high school and see what happens with sort of wonky dialogue. And yeah, it gave me everything I wanted and then some. And also, because I'm a huge fan of Miller's Crossing, as soon as he started talking about yeggs and bulls, I was like,
right.
Oh, I know where this guy's coming from.
Yeah. Like, between that and the obvious Cowboy Bebop stuff going on with Brendan, which still just amazes me. It's, for me, it lives all in how Joseph Gordon-Levitt, oh, you keep getting like shots of how he stands.
Yeah.
Just very the way he rolls his feet in his shoes.
Very Spike Spiegel.
Yes. Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah, no, I, like I said, like our big thing, like me and my friends watched it was, you know, if you know American noir at all, you know that there's like East Coast and West Coast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Generally, the Spillane and Chandler line, right?
Right.
You know, Spillane taking the East Coast, Chandler doing the West Coast. And so we saw, like, this is high school and, like, every time Like the posters, even you'd see it was a lot of outdoor, and it was like, oh, it's sunshine noir, which is that California noir thing,
right?
Which I've always loved. Just the idea of noir in a bright, sunny place is such a, you know, it's almost more interesting on film.
Yeah, evil under the sun. Yes,
right. Because again, there's that dissonance that you can get. And yeah, like not a Buffy fan or anything like that. Like wasn't really into the high school end of it. In my head, I was just like, whatever. But it was that, you know, let's see what you can do with this, because that is an interesting way to try to do it if you do it seriously. But again, going into it, like there's no reason to think that they're going to do it seriously.
Exactly. I think that's what part of what makes the film work so well is that it's so artificial.
Yeah.
But it never really winks at the camera. He just, Johnson is taking everything in this movie completely seriously.
Oh yeah.
Even as it's like obviously just completely, I don't want to say preposterous, but it's simply falls so far outside of reality that it's just impossible to get back there.
100%. And again, that all starts with the dialogue, which is amazing noir dialogue that lives or dies in delivery.
Yes.
I mean, you could read this stuff and like it, but I think you already have to be a big fan of it in order to like it on the page.
Uh-huh.
Because it is hyper-stylized. No human beings on Earth have ever spoken like anything in this movie. But if you can get the delivery right, again, or if you're predisposed to enjoy it, but especially if you can get the delivery right, it is a magical thing, because it just, it has so many internal rhythms and play and just timing.
Exactly. I think it's funny because when I watched it this time, there is actually less of that really stylized dialogue than I remembered.
Really?
More of the scenes when I watched it this time, like had, I mean, obviously the language is fanciful.
Right.
With lots of lines like, you know, where is he eating lunch, etc. Is there a what's the great line that he says when he, after he's been like knocked out in the pin's basement, he says something like, where's a wall with a door in it?
Right.
So just stuff, I mean, like that.
I think the first line, it's kind of early, but not really. That really just knocked me on my ass for the like, holy shit, this is pure Chandler level, you know, Spike Siegel, Chandler Miller's Crossing level stuff is the, what is it? I've got all five senses and I slept last night. That puts me six up on the lot of you.
And stale.
Just like that line, which again, it doesn't actually make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
But like you spit it out just right and you're just like, oh shit.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's kind of the thing. That's the key to the delivery in the movie.
Yeah.
But there are lines like that, but there are points at which like it's very deliberately pretending to be a neo-noir set in high school. Like all of Brendan's conversations with Truman, for example.
Right.
With the assistant vice principal. Very much like it's, you're meant to think of particular scenes from noir in which the private detective is talking to, like, you know, the chief of police or whatever.
Yep.
But a lot of the other scenes are just the people, like people having sort of conversations with each other. So it's not quite as, the genre of satire isn't quite as pointed. You get this sort of, often it tips almost into sort of naturalism, but then they'll use a word or two that just jumps out at you. And you're like, okay, we are still in this hyper-stylized world.
Right.
And this is just something that I found this time when watching, but never before. Maybe I'm just more, I don't know, inured to like, stylized dialogue.
I think so. I think, again, like so much of it is really, and like again, it's that great hard boiled stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go to every rat in town together, said show your hands. If anyone's actually seen the pin, you get a crowd full of pockets.
Like, oh, yeah. crowd full of full pockets. That is one of my favorite lines in this whole thing.
Yeah, there's, and again, like, that's the thing. It's kind of, for me, it's still just relentlessly hyper-stylized. And I agree, it's not every single line, but it's every single scene.
Mm. It is in every single scene. And every single scene, one of the things I love about this movie, yeah, and the script is every single scene has purpose. Like, it moves things forward. There's so little fat in this movie that it's positively wiry. I don't know. It's DJ Qualls sort of physique in this film. Which, because I was sort of tracking when I watched it this time, I'm like, so what does each scene do? And each and every scene drops something new, points Brendan in a new direction, you know, or gives him some vital piece of the puzzle. Even if we don't always know it's vital, it is vital.
Right.
And everything, and of course everything comes together in ways that, if you know the genre, will not surprise you one
exactly
bit. But still, it's the pleasure is in watching all the pieces come together so well.
Yeah. I will say that I think dialogue wise, the one thing I would flag, weirdly, that always sticks out to me as an almost mistake, mm-hmm, was what Dode calls Brendan Seamus. Oh, I just feel they leaned in a little too hard.
Yeah, maybe.
It just felt like almost like they saw the curtain for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
They were all just in high school, just this, and I get why he's doing it. I understand that, but it just always feels like just that one quarter of an inch too far. If I had to, pick a nit, which I don't, but there you go.
I mean, it is a very delicate balancing act in this film.
I also do appreciate that Johnson cast Nora Zehetner after just seeing her in May. And I'm like, no, you cannot look at Nora Zehetner and go like, I need to cast something for her age group at the time that's like a neo-noir, like California noir.
Right.
With her age group, and like, I need a femme fatale. You cannot see her and not go, oh, well, there you are. We're done. I mentioned the movie to a friend who has never seen it. Like, just last week, actually. I just mentioned, oh, I get to watch Brick. Like, oh, I hadn't seen it. And I was like, yeah, da, da. And I just pulled up just a picture of Nora Zehetner. Like, oh, yeah, no, that's the femme fatale. Like, yeah, yeah.
Yep, pretty much. Yep. She looks it. It's funny because I, by and large, I love the performances in this film. I find Zehetner's overall performance might be my least favorite.
Really?
Yeah. I think she's. She dials down her affect so much to be so sort of sphinx-like and blank and sort of trying to play sort of being seductive but sympathetic at the same time with Brendan, that I just found it a notch too far on the dial for me.
Okay.
Not that it messed up the movie for me or anything.
No.
But I thought, what if Megan Good played the femme fatale? That would be a thing.
Also, and again, you get to, like, there's an earlier novel with Brendan out there where she did.
I thought that would also be cool. Also, I think Megan Good should have played Laura, the femme fatale, and she should have played Kara, who she plays in the film.
Right.
And she could have played. Yep, and she could have played Emily as well. What's the name?
Getting a little weird.
That would be very weird.
That's like David Lynch's Brick.
there are some decidedly Lynchian scenes in this film as well. Pretty much anything taking place in the Pins' house or basement.
God, yes.
Feels like Johnson is pulling some sound and sort of visual, design cues from Lynch.
Also character-wise, because I will say that the Pins' mother is the one character who makes it, like, you need to see a parent.
Right.
But, like, the Pins' mother who's just like, I guess this is normal, is almost like just a weird step in the wrong direction. Like, it's funny the first time.
Uh-huh.
But when you see her just like pouring milk out for all this, you know, the soldiers in the place, right, you start going, oh, this is going to snap if this goes on too much longer.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. And that's also probably where I think where Johnson mines the most humor from the scenario with the pin. Like when they first talk about him, they're like, oh, he's old, like 26 or something.
Right.
And then you see him and he lives at home and the house is full of like weird animal tchotchkes. And it's just, and if your house wasn't like that, you've been to a house like that.
Oh yeah, like, no, like my grandmother's house in Staten Island, like when I was growing up, like that was, you know, it looked like that.
Yes.
Down to like the weird basement that was, you know, because all the pipes go through it, so it has this drop ceiling that's like almost the height of a door.
Yep.
I also just love the pin's office with the backwards desk and just all the affectations.
Oh yeah.
No, a random accordion in an accordion case.
The lamp in the back of the van. Just he has like a floor, like a table lamp in his van.
Yeah.
Like that's just so freaking great. I don't know.
And that's it. It's like every moment, like visually and plot wise and dialogue wise, is just so heightened off of reality.
Yes.
Then it becomes its own thing.
Oh.
Yeah. This is the thing I saw with Joseph Gordon-Levitt that was just like, oh, okay, he's doing real shit now. That led me to like, you know, the whatever, all these other weird movies that he did.
Because... I think, yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, I think this was probably may have been the first Gordon-Levitt movie that I saw where it wasn't, you know, him as a kid in a sitcom or something.
Right. Yeah, because I know, like, I went from this and then, like, not long ago, like, when The Lookout came out and...
Right. And Lookout was not much long afterwards.
That was like 2 years.
Next year. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, his uncredited moment, Brothers Bloom, which people used to argue that didn't happen. Because why would he go uncredited? Like, no, it's just a Ryan Johnson thing. Just let it alone.
Yep. He'll be in all that. Oh, right. He was also, I did see him in Mysterious Skin not long before I saw Brick. And that was. I think that's a Greg Araki movie, so that's a genuinely serious film. So,
can we also just talk about just in terms of physicality? Besides the careful foot placement, which was gorgeous,
oof,
the fact that he could wear this kind of like members only tan jacket, but the way he holds himself and the way he has his hands in his pockets makes him move like it's a trench coat.
Yeah.
Is, and it is partially the Spike Siegel thing, I understand, but really that was just the 1940s, like, he needs a trench coat moment that is so wonderfully done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the moment I really noticed the Cowboy Bebop similarities comes in the scene where he fights Brad Bramish.
Oh, yeah. All of his fight scenes where he just, I do love that that's like the visual language of Brendan fighting.
Yeah.
It's just he gets knocked out of the ass, but he doesn't stay down.
Right, and he fights incredibly dirty.
Like, oh God, yes.
Which is the other great thing. I think the fight scene with Bramish is probably some of my favorite bits of physical comedy as well in the film. He's already started the fight when Bramish is still trying to like talk to his friends.
Yeah.
He kicks him in the shin. He gets knocked down, kicks Bramish in the shin, and then Bramish comes at him and he kicks him in the shin in the exact same spot.
Yeah. And Bramish sold it so well too. Just that combination of pain and just sheer stop doing that.
Yes, you just get how incredibly stupid Bramish is.
Sure.
It's because he lets himself fall for the same move immediately, which I just thought was I thought that was great.
I will say that this also is still, and like, it's one of those, like, if I don't watch this movie that often, and I probably should, but whenever I watch it, I'm always reminded that this is probably my favorite foot chase in cinema history.
Oh.
Just the Brennan being chased around the school by that guy.
Oh, yeah, by the...
Where it's just the sound of the footsteps and, you know, the... like the different ways they're running and the different locations, and you're just like, it's such a beautiful scene. And then it turns out that that's the key to the entire chase.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this perfect build. And I will say that when I saw it in the theater, even the sheer like tension break laugh that the entire audience got at that clang that happens completely off camera was a physical thing.
Well, as soon as he takes off his shoes and you realize you've been listening for the last minute to nothing but the sounds of like...
Right, that's what I'm saying, it's right? Like, it's,
And you're like, oh, I get it. I get what they're doing with this scene. Yeah, right. It's brilliant use of sound design. I agree.
Yeah, but then again, ending with that clang is just like this great like Acme punchline on it.
Yes. Yeah, there is. Yeah, there's definitely, there's a little bit of Looney Tunes in that. In that moment as well.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what we haven't done? We have not told anyone who may be listening like what this movie is even about.
God. Oh, you want the whole tale?
Tell me the tale.
Oh, how do you even sum this movie up? That is part of the problem, too.
Well, yeah, because it's a neo-noir, the plot is incredibly... thorny and much
here, the IMDb one sentence plot is funny.
Okay.
A teenage loner pushes his way into the underworld of a high school crime ring to investigate the disappearance of his ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, well, you know, it's...
I mean, technically, a lot of that is true.
it does seem to be that way. I should also say this movie could just be titled MacGuffin, because that's what the brick in question is. It's just pure MacGuffin energy. It's also the girlfriend, which is, I don't know, which I find interesting.
Yeah.
But one thing that always messes me up is that Emily Draven's character is named Emily, and I keep on thinking that I've got it wrong. I'm like, well, her name can't be Emily. That's the name of the actress. And then... and I look, I'm like, no, it is actually Emily. People who watch Lost or watching Lost at the time would recognize Emily Draven, because she appears on a few seasons of Lost. This came out just before that series. So
right.
Yeah. You know,
also this is the start of one of my favorite film collaborations, which is the Noah Segan is in literally everything Rian Johnson has ever done.
Oh.
Actually, hold on. That might not be true. I think he's in everything that Rian Johnson has ever written.
Huh.
And the reason I say that is...
Is he in The Last Jedi?
Yes.
Oh, he was. Okay.
But what I don't think he was in was Terriers.
Ah.
Because Rian Johnson did do an episode of Terriers.
Right.
But he just directed it. He didn't write it.
And he was in the episode. Well, I know Johnson directed two episodes of Breaking Bad. And he was in Ozymandias, the last one. But I don't think he was in Fly, because, I mean, there is almost nobody in that.
Well, almost anything. Right? I mean, yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, pretty darn close.
You know, Star Wars. God knows, Glass Onion, Knives Out, Poker Face.
Yep.
Yeah.
Brothers Bloom, and he was in, of course, he was in Looper.
Yeah.
As,
he's Bloom. A lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But it has become that thing of whenever I watch a Rian Johnson thing, I'm, he was actually in the Breaking Bad stuff, uncredited. But I don't see him for Terriers. I think that might be the one he missed.
Huh.
Yeah, I just always love playing the where is he game.
Yeah, where's Joseph Gordon-Levitt? Where is Noah Segan?
Right. And again, Joseph Gordon-Levitt might not show up, but Noah Segan's going to show up.
Sooner or later. Yeah. Yes, I enjoy. I like seeing him in season two of Poker Face, but also, and I didn't realize this at the time, Noah Segan is really small. He's a really small, like he's probably my size. Like that's not big. And I was just, but I didn't really catch it until the scene at the culvert, at the drain pipe, when you've got Haas and Fleiss and Levitt and Segan, right, all in the same frame. And he's kind of a little farther back than everyone, but he also looks just absolutely miniature compared to everybody else.
Yeah, he's a little dude.
He's a little dude, yeah.
Ain't nothing wrong with a little dude.
nothing wrong. I speak from first-hand experience. Ain't nothing wrong with a little dude, because that's me. I'm a little dude. And I must point out other little dudes when they show up.
There you go.
It starts. I'll fill in some more of the story. Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays Brendan. He is indeed a loner, a high school loner. He is the ex-boyfriend of Emily. They've been split for 3 months, and she's kind of disappeared. And the movie essentially kicks off with a note from her and a phone call from her. And when she says, which seems to be this sort of push-pull, like, I need your help, but stay away from me at the same time. So he decides to go track her down. And this takes him through scene after scene where he tries to find her. Eventually he does. And she says, you know, I don't need you anymore. Get lost. Right. And then she shows up dead at the drain pipe when he goes to find her. And then the movie becomes about him essentially getting into the underworld, figuring out what's wrong, getting revenge on those who might have wronged her. And that's pretty much how everything spins out for the rest of the movie.
Yes. Including at the beginning of the film, however, the one weird, I don't want to call it like a mistake, but it's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a technical thing. And it doesn't bother me necessarily, but I've always noticed it. And I like went and looked like not long after the film came out, and Johnson even mentioned it.
Oh.
That there is a, like, there is one weird mistake in the film.
Is it when they go to the craft services table and suddenly somebody's like, hey, can't film this?
Yeah.
So, yes.
It's early on when Brendan first goes to the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking to Emily.
Okay, so pretty much
and the car like, drives by. Yeah. Right. So the way the car drives by.
Uh-huh.
You see that, like, the cigarette gets flicked out?
From the passenger side, yeah. And it should be the driver's side, right?
Yep. It is a small little thing. It doesn't actually matter. And I get why. Like, you didn't, because otherwise he probably could have clocked her.
Right.
There's a better chance if she'd been coming by, but also, spatially, you needed Laura to hear Emily to hear it first, and yeah. Mm-hmm. But it did hit me with that, like, wait, that's impossible.
Maybe she's just very clumsy with her cigarettes, and she throws them at the passenger side.
Like, with a... Probably with someone in the passenger side, even.
Yeah. Heads up!
Yikes.
This supports my theory that this all takes place in a mirror universe.
Ah,
everything in it takes place in a bizarro universe where everything is upside down. People flick cigarettes out the passenger side.
Fair enough.
Of their cars. It's almost certainly it. One thing I really enjoyed about this film, which is, I mean, it's kind of a noir staple, is that Brendan is throughout the first at least half of the movie is playing, he's playing everybody against each other. Like he's basically like a pinball who just like hits things and see, you know,
right.
Sees where they go, or, you know,
yeah.
Or everybody else is the pinball and he's the bumpers. I don't know. Don't well, follow I mean, my again,
but like his own plans are that is his only plan ever.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Just shake the tree and see what falls out. Right. See who raises their hand. You know, whose pockets are empty when they raise their hand. But then I think about an hour in. I think at the point where you start, where the guy comes at him with the knife,
right?
He begins to get things wrong, like the problems mount, and he's no longer in control because the guy comes at him with a knife, and he assumes at first that it must be the pin coming, coming to kill him, but it's not. But then it's like it's not the pin, and then he gets the call from he calls Dode. And Dode's like, I'm going to rat you out because I saw you move Emily's body and you're the one who killed her. And he's right. like, well, why'd you send the guy with a knife? He's like, I didn't do that. You know, why would I need to? So it's like this spiraling problem. And then it's like two problems. And then I think probably when he gets the call from Truman, where he calls Truman, and no longer has the sort of the support or tacit, you know, support of the Bulls, right. The vice principal, then that's like the third problem when everything is out of control. And then that leads to the low point of which he thinks that Dode is about to rat him out, but then Tug kills Dode. And then that sort of sets the rest of the movie in motion.
Yeah, and I mean, and we're even set up that he's going to be making mistakes because, you know, right. like Laurie even tells him, like, you haven't slept, you've swallowed a lot of blood, you just, like, you need a doctor.
Yes, yeah, he starts coughing. He's clearly sick and, you know, trying to recover.
Yeah, and it's just, he's, you know, there's that moment where he goes to the tunnel where we have the whole big, you know, Dode killing, that whole reveal, where he's barely able to walk. And then he takes this like moment, and again, you're just watching his feet.
Mm-hmm.
And he steps up on this curb, and he just stops,
right?
And like gathers himself, and then he's fine again. And you can tell, like, this is like he's just draining the tank further and further and further.
Uh huh. Yeah, it's great stuff, and it's all paced so precisely.
Yeah.
I think part of this is because I know some people don't like Rian Johnson very much. They don't like, not personally, but they don't like his work. And I think it's partly that he's, and they say, you know, his movies suck and they don't make any sense. But okay. I think the real problem is that his movies are actually too crafted.
I'm going to counter people. That though.
Mm-hmm.
Because that didn't start until he went wide. And when he went wide was with Looper. Which right. arguably is not a great film in a lot of ways.
It's probably his weakest.
Yeah, I still enjoy a lot of it, but it is kind of this makes no sense, this has issues. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, what do we get? We get the Star Wars thing, so we have all those people.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't, like, the people I know who started watching him with Rick and Brothers Bloom, like, you never used to hear that. And right. there were less people, so I don't know how you want to deal with that problem, but there is that issue of when he went, you know, he went wide with arguably his weakest film.
Yeah, that could be, yeah.
I think people were just like, oh, this guy, and they didn't go back necessarily.
Right. Oh, okay.
Brick makes nothing but sense.
It does, although I think I've been in the subreddits, and there are people who just simply, and not even like bad faith, you know, arguers, people who just don't seem to understand what they're watching.
Okay, but I can go on a Reddit fucking subreddit and find like a million people who don't understand the Muppet movie.
Sure, but when I'm talking about what people say, Reddit is a place where people say things.
Sure.
I feel like
I can't count too much on it.
I mean, it's not like I'm saying Charlie Brown had hoes because somebody on the internet said it. I understand that what you're saying though.
But yeah, no, that's what you're saying too. Like, I do see that as well. I've always discounted because of when it was being said.
Right. Yeah.
And these aren't people who went back and watched Bricker Brothers Fool. They saw maybe a Star Wars and they went and watched Looper, or they saw Looper and then watched Star Wars. They didn't like, you know, one of them and whatever.
Yeah.
And I get it. Yeah. And just to toss in a note, because I don't know that we're ever going to really do it, although we didn't think we were going to do this for years.
Yeah.
Brothers Bloom is, we kind of mentioned this once, we were talking about something else. I forget what it was. That Brothers Bloom is kind of the almost more refined version of this. And it isn't in any way, shape, or form in like plot-wise or anything.
Okay, yeah.
But it's just the Rian Johnson knew more about making film and it was just a little more technically proficient.
Yeah, I think... Excuse me again. I think one of the things about, Brick is that, I mean, it really is made from bits and pieces.
Yeah.
You know, it is stitched together and very, I don't know what the budget was, but it can't be high. I mean,
no.
if it was more than $5 million, I'd be shocked.
Oh, God, yes. No, and I know a lot of people who like Brothers Bloom more than Brick, and I've always been like, I actually like Brick more because it is a little bit more raw.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more immersive, too.
Hmm.
For me, at least. I feel like Brothers Bloom is this great heist con man movie.
Yeah.
That moves, it sings, it is, again, if you like Brick, you're going to love that, and vice versa. But there's something about Brick that just feels way more immersive. Like, I finished Brick and it feels like the world is just like a little washed out in color.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like you're trapped in the bottle of noir for a little bit after you see it.
Yes, that is, which is what you want from.
Right.
I think that's the mark of a really good movie is that it pulls you in and then it keeps you there even, and you take part of it with you when you leave the theater. I mean, that's
right.
That's the thing. Yeah. And Brick definitely does that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is incredibly immersive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that does come from the fact that, you know, again, we're going to have a chase scene that's going to just rely on sound more than anything. You know, we're going to have moments where we play with Brennan's glasses and vision.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every sense is engaged in the film at some point or another.
Yes. Also, what I find of interest. Speaking of that, you know, that sound, that whole sound design thing with the foot chase scene, she reminds me of nothing more than the ending of The Third Man.
Yeah.
When Orson Welles' character is being chased through the sewers beneath the city. And it's all just shots, like canted angle shots, which I'm surprised Rian Johnson didn't do more of those, frankly. And just sounds of footsteps echoing and water dripping echoing back and forth. And everybody's trying to like get a bead on where everybody is by the sound. And it is, I mean, it's a brilliant scene, if you ask me.
Oh yeah.
I'm thinking that Johnson, if not calling out directly to that, almost certainly saw The Third Man and took that with him.
Yes.
Apparently he wanted his cast to read Dashiell Hammett, but not to watch noir films in preparation.
Right.
For this, which I think is an interesting choice, but I understand why you do that. He didn't want the cast to ape the mannerisms of particular noir characters too much.
Yeah.
You want to keep just a little sliver of naturalism. I think that really makes otherwise it would have been just way too broad.
Oh, 100%. And I do think also that, like, again, if you're watching something like Poker Face or, you know, Knives Out or Glass Onion, like the later his return to kind of that noir space isn't possible without Brick specifically.
Agreed.
You know, is like, again, it's that more accomplished, more professional film. Of course, the newer ones are. He has 20 years of experience under his belt.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that Brick still just holds up as, I'd argue just one of the great like noir films of all time.
Yeah.
It's incredible that that was his first movie.
Yes.
And the saddest part is just that we didn't get Daniel Craig in there.
There is a work that has gone missing.
Weird version of this as one of the Knives Out movies. There's a surreal fucking version of this.
Maybe they're just watching it like on TV or something. I would love to see. Oh, no, what they were watching on TV is the Daniel Craig starring version of Brick.
Right.
No, yeah. I did that to see him eat, not to get you fit.
Again, such a great line too.
Such a great line. Yes, indeed.
Apparently, the teacher that he calls out for is an actual teacher at the school where they shot.
Oh, that's cute.
They shot it all in the town he grew up in, so I'm assuming it was a teacher he had.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yep.
Okay, this makes sense. I don't know. There seems to be a real familiarity with the alleyways and sort of
culverts.
And
there's a love of location going on in the film.
Very much. Even though the locations often look not bland, but sort of, they look kind of anonymous in the way that almost every city has these sorts of like little sort of secret backways that you know only certain people know about, or right. Well, everybody knows about, but only certain people know about. At the same time, I don't know how else to put it.
No, that's completely it.
Yeah,
it's everyone kind of has heard of them, but only certain people actually use them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
Like the parking lot behind Coffee and Pie, oh my, and stuff like that.
Yeah, or knowing where there's like one last payphone. Yeah, that is the other thing about this film is that I know when it came out, but just still everyone having like old flip phones, and I'm just like, oh yeah, uh-huh.
Yep. I was actually, when I was watching this time, I was like, I thought, could you make this movie like set now with cell phones? And you still could. You could. Yeah. But you just wouldn't be quite as like, you wouldn't have to like be running to a phone. But other than that, you could still have, because an astonishing amount of this movie takes place with Brendan talking on the phone to people.
Yes. And just looking at the time.
Yeah. And I think, and I was wondering about that, because it just, and I realized the function it serves is like, he just, often it's like a little transition from one scene to the next, where he gives the kind information or gets information that the audience needs to hear,
right,
and that will move you from one part, you know, of the movie to the next.
Yeah, I also think it serves that after, outside of like the two or so outside ones, that he's always, you know, trying to get the sleep that he desperately needs, and it never happens.
Yes,
but it also always propels him back out.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like this, you know, like a little elastic band. He's going out, he's doing a thing, he's coming home to collapse, and then the phone fucking rings again.
Exactly. I love that wonderful scene where he finds out something's happening at midnight, but he doesn't know where it is, and it's the culvert. And in the foreground of the shot, you've got the little sort of symbol of the culvert or the drain pipe. And behind it is the digital clock, which reads 11:59. Uh-huh. And it's like, he's like, something's happening. He can't be there. And again, that's where I felt like the pull of David Lynch, you know, with especially with Twin Peaks, where terrible things are happening, but you know something is happening, but you don't exactly know what or where, but it's just this dread and helplessness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Just, you know, for 20 years now, just been one of those like great favorite films.
Oh, absolutely. Anything else to muse upon? People, if you haven't seen Brick, and I don't know why you would listen to us if you haven't seen this movie.
Right.
But
it is a question.
We highly recommend it. It's one of our favorites. If you haven't guessed.
If you haven't guessed. And we're going to be back next week with a, I don't know, reference film?
Yeah, a film that Johnson sort of very much was inspired Brick. It is Coen Brothers' second feature film, Miller's Crossing.
Yep.
Which is another favorite film of mine.
Yeah, and the Dash Hammett thing, so.
Oh, yeah. Most of, and yeah, and as well, we'll see the plot is quite similar in some ways. Sure.
But also just the tone, the feel, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So until then, we'll hear some music.
Woo! Music! Woo! I want to see the pin.
Yeah, you do.